This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 71 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we made a detour over to the Briar Patch to pick up Patrick Devlin to help us discuss future human cultural evolution. Mike, I'm excited to have Patrick on the show today because we have been talking about having Patrick on the show for quite a long time now.
Yeah, I just got to the bridge, Zachary, and I saw the helmsman put the coordinates in. I wondered what was going on. I took a look at my pad, and I see that Patrick's going to be joining us. How about we just go ahead and just do a site-to-site transport and get him right here on the bridge?
Transporter Chief, energize.
Patrick Devlin, welcome to the Starship of Theseus.
Thanks, guys. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for coming through the Briar Patch to come pick me up for this conversation today.
Patrick, you look so young. Your skin is flawless. What's your secret, man?
Well, there's this planet that's way better than Ryza. You get younger and younger as you sit there.
Has something to do with the rings. Don't ask me to explain it.
I need to spend my next vacation here, that's for sure.
Well, Patrick, you have been with us on Metatrex for a long time now. You were our first associate producer. I forget what episode you started joining us on for associate producer, but it was quite a long time ago. And for a long time, you and I have been talking about having you on the show. And I asked you, well, what do you want to talk about? What philosophical topics or what issues you might want to discuss? And you said, I want to talk about future human cultural evolution. And I said, well, I don't know anything about that, but I can think about it. And then when we get that far, we'll have you on the show. And here we are, episode 71. On Metatrex, and we're going to talk about future human cultural evolutions. Can you tell us just a little bit about what about this topic stirred you to want to join us so much to talk about that topic?
Well, I'm a big fan of Star Trek because of the social aspect of it and how we can evolve past what we are today into more of a utopian society that it would seem the Federation has. And in that show, they juxtapose the other species or races to ours, which are different things within our own society that we can look at. And I find that extremely interesting. And I'd like to talk about that in more of a philosophical sense.
Yeah, before we dive into that, we say this every single podcast, without your patronage and your support for Metatrex, we just couldn't do this. And you, as Zachary mentioned, you've been with us since almost the beginning. I mean, going way back there in the Wayback Machine. And before we dive into the topic, I just want to ask you, how did you come to discover Trek FM and get involved in the network? And why in the world Metatrex, man?
Okay.
Of all the shows on Trek FM, you took a show on Star Trek and philosophy?
So I looked in on my the podcast on my phone, and I just typed in Star Trek, and a whole bunch came up from Trek FM and from other areas. And I listened to basically all of them for a while, and I knocked off pretty much everything that wasn't Trek FM fairly quickly. But I loved the philosophy one. My favorite episode early on was the Poker Game of Life. Was mm-hmm. that? Or the Poker Game of Starship,
oh, yeah,
or whatever?
That was a long time ago.
And I loved that episode, and I immediately decided that after that episode that I wanted to support the network, but more importantly, I wanted to support Metatrex and what you guys were doing with Star Trek and philosophy.
Well, that is awesome. We love having you as an associate producer of Metatrex, and we appreciate your support. You've been very supportive, not just with your patronage to the network, but you've been supportive letting us know when you've enjoyed particular podcasts, throwing ideas at us, and we appreciate that. We appreciate your involvement.
Yeah, I mean this sincerely. Podcasting is definitely a grind. You know, it takes hours and hours to record and produce podcasts. And even then, you throw it out into the world and you go, I hope people find what we said interesting or got some value out of it. We don't know how it went. And then when we get great feedback, when we stir something in a listener, when listeners write and go, oh man, I never thought about it in that way before. I want to chat with you guys more about that. That's amazing. That's what keeps us going.
For sure. And you've always been great to do that. So we always give you a shout out and a thank you on the program. But since we have you here on the Starship of Theseus, we just want to say thank you sincerely from the bottom of our hearts for your support of Metatrex and Trek FM.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I just want to see you guys churning out more and more episodes. I love them every week.
Well, as I was thinking before the show of how we might go about thinking about and talking about future human cultural evolution, I was thinking, it's not clear to me what angle you'd like to attack the discussion from, because, you know, Mike and I come to it from a philosophy standpoint. You come to it more from a sociological and economic standpoint. And in my mind, there's just a couple of really radical, distinct ways you can think about future human cultural evolution. One is you can think of it as such a product of random chance, you know, the random events that happen in the course of the unfolding of history, where you really can't predict with any degree of certainty, any degree of reliability, what will happen with our culture or our race, either biologically or culturally down the road. On the other hand, you can think of it in terms of culture being developing towards some sort of trajectory. And I think Star Trek kind of waffles back and forth on this a bit. Mm-hmm. Star Trek seems to apply, a lot of the times in Star Trek, it seems to imply that as not just human evolution, but even the evolution of alien cultures, that there's a natural evolution towards something like the Federation. Cultures learning to agree and get along in harmony, solve their problems, come together for political and defense purposes, and that there's a trajectory toward unification rather than diversity in terms of the trajectory of cultural evolution. But you can look at the course of human history and look at all the catastrophes, all the uncertain events that have unfolded to lead us where we are here. I think it's significantly open for debate whether you can look at the course of our own, you know, here in the real world, our own historical cultural evolution, and say that there was any quote unquote trajectory to it. Certainly, there's been change over time, but not necessarily a directionality to it. So that's my kind of, you know, broad brushstroke two ways of cutting it up from a philosophy standpoint. But I'm curious what your take is on it from more of a sociological standpoint.
Well, we typically see trends in history that culminate in massive wars. I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, you guys even spoke about this would be the Great Peace. The historians are already starting to talk about this period being the Great Peace after World War II. There's been a lot of skirmishes, the Cold War and such, but there's been no massive wars. For some of the people listening, they might think of, say, the Iraqi war is a massive war, but it really wasn't. It lasted 187 days or something like that, and it was really two countries involved. So what you end up having, though, is you seem to have, and this actually goes back to what you were talking about last week with the Cardassians, is you have a culture that's very much run down the middle, and they're really more into the arts and the sciences and stuff like that. And then as their two sides start to split farther and farther apart from that, and get more radical, they become more left and more right. All of society doesn't break down, but it all becomes more into blaming someone for why it's not the way it used to be, why things have changed so much. And most people want to push against change. They don't like change, not massive change anyway. So you end up veering yourself, and you have multiple countries doing it at multiple times. You end up veering yourself back into a world war.
Well, inside the Star Trek universe, the, for lack of a better term, more utopian society that we see in Star Trek was spawned out of crisis, right? We hear about World War III in Star mm-hmm. Trek. We hear about the eugenics wars. And it's out of those crises that we get the phoenix of, literally the phoenix in First Contact, but the phoenix leading to, cultural phoenix leading to the Federation.
Right, and I think that's kind of the two ways it can go after a war. And I don't know if you'll ever see it go to one way or the other and stay that way either. You might end up at the utopian version of the Federation that we see in Star Trek, and it might then reverse back. You'll see, like, say, the Maquis are causing trouble. Now people rally against them and anyone who's like them. Or the Cardassians start poking at the border. So now everyone wants all Cardassians gone from all Federation areas. And then you'll have people that fight heavily against those people, which causes a chaos inside the society. And this could all come from where Star Trek is. We could end up back at that same World War IV could happen. We just haven't seen it yet.
I think what we see sometimes in the Star Trek universe is art imitating life to some degree. There is an ebb and flow to history, as Zachary and I have mentioned a couple of times here on the podcast. You know, this period that we're in has been known as the Great Peace, and this is this post-World War II world that we're living in. But it certainly seems like tensions are building, and I'm not going to throw out a prediction that we're going to have, you know, Armageddon or World War III or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, it certainly seems like tensions are rising. In the Star Trek universe, I think the unifying factor for planet Earth was that first contact situation with the Vulcans. Suddenly, humanity realized, hey, we're not alone in the universe. And humanity was able to unite together because of two things, because of warp drive and because of first contact. Those two things united Earth in a way, and I'm quoting Star Trek, in a way that it had never been united before. But I think as far as humanity's cultural evolution is concerned, I think that's a very natural thing to see happen over a period of time. Yeah, that peace lasted much longer, and, you know, we had the paradise that we talk about in DS9, but we know that paradise is somehow flawed, and you mentioned the Maquis, and I think that's a great example. I think you have that natural ebb and flow, and I think that's something that, honestly, if they hadn't had explored in the Star Trek universe, I think two things as a result of that. First of all, I don't think that it would have been authentic because, again, human cultural evolution has shown us time and time again that there is an ebb and flow with, you know, tension and peacetime. And the other thing is I think that to some degree Star Trek loses its relevance. If you paint too much of a utopian future, to, you know, this utopian hope that we have for the future, then what you fail to do is be relevant to the world that we're living in now.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. I also think that if you look at the way they portray it in Star Trek compared to our own history, if you look at Star Trek, one of the big things is there's no scarcity anymore. Nobody wants for anything. People work because they want to work. They live because they live, you know, to do what they want to do, things they enjoy. And granted, we do see only like the top 1% of people, and we don't see how the average, like say, New Yorker lives. We just see how the starship captains and the crews and the commands and they live. But we get a sense of that everyone has enough to live. And if we look at our own history, when we look back after World War II, you know, the economy really turned upward for most of the rest Western world. And the middle class really jumped up a bunch of pegs from where it was at, say, the turn of the century, 1900. The middle class was much, I don't want to say lower. They weren't as well off as they were from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And now that the economy seems to be coming down a little in places, it seems that, we're, like you said, the ebb and flow, and now we're going back the other way. On, well, I need to get back to where I was, and who do I blame, seems to be a human trait.
Well, I think it's certainly clear that Star Trek, part of the Star Trek utopia is that it solved the economic problem of scarcity. People don't really want for anything anymore in the sense of their basic needs, food, shelter, and whatnot, right? So they have the luxury and the liberty to pursue their interests. And, you know, and in Star Trek, that means, you know, in parentheses, and we get to be the best versions of ourselves, right? Right. So all that kind of comes together. And maybe I'm thinking a little too abstractly here, but I was trying to think of different possible trajectories that cultural evolution can have, you know, know, what are the different possible paths it could take? So even despite the ebb and flow that you were describing, Mike, it seems to me that there could be an overall trend towards some sort of progress. Maybe not utopian in some sort of radically idealistic sense, but some sort of cultural progress toward improvement, social and economic and whatnot, even given the ebbs and flows culturally, even given the ebbs and flows of war and peacetime and whatnot. So that's one option, is this trajectory towards progress. But I think in my lifetime, I can certainly identify areas where we've had cultural regression, where we seem to have gone backwards in some areas, whether it's literacy, whether it's manners, whether it's, you know, how we perceive other people, politics. You know, I think there's certainly been a regression that's taken place. I don't think it's a given that we're going to progress forward. It may be in the long run. I think the problem with making a prediction about the future is the farther you project your projection into the future, the less certain it is that it's actually going to come to fruition, right?
Right.
So I've seen regression. So one possible option is that we peak at a certain point and then we regress in some way, and maybe another species becomes dominant through biological evolution. I have no idea, but we could also stagnate. I think, I think once you reach a certain kind of economic stability, there's no impetus to keep improving. So once we have our basic needs, you know, we've got our food, we've got our shelter, we've got our iPhone or space iPhones, what else do we need? Do we really need to keep pushing ourselves to improve past a certain point? And I can see this, sort of culturally in the world of technology. You get to a point where, you know, we've solved all the basic problems of technology. So let's just put a new computer out there, make another iPhone, publish another app, and you just kind of stagnate, right? You don't actually move forward in any way. I could imagine some sort of cyclical process where, you know, we get ebbs and flows. And I think we've seen this over time. And if you look back at world history, you can go from, you know, well-educated and literate and, you know, strong economy to bad economy, and people get less literate. And, you know, over the course of the centuries, that turns into something a bit more cyclical, maybe not in any real strict sense, but there's certainly ebbs and flows to it. But I could imagine some sort of compromise along the lines of a Hegelian dialectic, where the ebbs and flows, or the endpoints, back and, you know, sort of jumping back and forth between two extremes, leads to solving problems and moving the world forward. And then over time, in the course of these ebbs and flows, we actually do solve problems and use the ebbs and flows to generate progress.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think even if we don't necessarily, like you said, as farther you go out, the harder it is to predict or even become close to right, because anything can happen between now and that point. We could be visited by aliens. It changes everything. But I think even with that, we are always going to see steps forward and backwards either way. We may be on a trajectory to go backwards, see two steps forwards and think we fixed it, and then right back backwards, or vice versa. We might be going forwards in whatever progress we want to speak about, whether it's economics or social issues or cultural issues, whatever. But we could be heading forward and then take two steps back. Everyone freaks out, and then we just start heading back forward again. So I don't think it's necessarily one trajectory that's part of the problem. I think there's so many factors into this that it can change on a dime.
I think the problem that I see, this may be a bit of a tangent, but the problem that I see around me in the world is that people don't take the time to think about these things, right? For all you know, they're stagnating and they don't know it, right? They think they're being progressive, right? I got my iPhones, and I've got my creature comforts, and I've got food on my table. So we've had progress, right? But that ignores all the problems in the world, and it ignores all the areas for self-improvement and improvement in the world. And I'm interested in finding a motivating factor that leads people to take some ownership over what the future state of the world will be, rather than just stagnating. Because I think, honestly, we've reached to the point where we've peaked, and maybe not peaked, but we've plateaued at a certain point. You know, we have solved some of those problems of scarcity, even though there's a huge economic discrepancy in this country. But for a non-trivial portion of the country, we have met our basic needs. People have enough to eat. They may or may not have a job, but they've got a roof over their head. You know, the middle class might be shrinking, but it's not like there's mass homelessness where everyone, you know, where there's a disaster and there's no more places to live. We have a fairly comfortable middle class society generally. So given that, what is the impetus to help people keep improving and leading towards whatever it is that will lead to that kind of cultural change that all of us get excited about when we talk about the Star Trek universe?
It's ironic that you bring up the fact that we have our creature conference and that people might not want to go forward, because I think people also overreact to the fact that they think they're more broke than past generations. They think they actually make less than past generations, but when you look at it, my parents didn't own two cars. They didn't have cable with 10,000 channels or cell phones for four members of the family. And a lot of those things...
We didn't have avocado toast either.
Right. But they didn't spend money on those things. Those things would be considered fringe benefits. They would not be considered something you needed to have. And now, you can't survive without a cell phone in a modern professional world. You just need one to get by. You can't go with just one parent. If you have kids, you have to have two cars. And even when you don't have kids, half the time, one person has to go to work one way, one person has to go back work the other way. There's no bus system nearby, depending on where you live. I live in New York. There's always a bus. But that's not true of all of the country. And even when you said with the mass homelessness, I grew up in an era in the 80s in New York where there was mass homelessness. In the early 90s, there was mass homelessness. Now you see a homeless person and you're like surprised. You're like, wow, there's a homeless guy on the train. I feel terrible for him. But back in the 80s, people would see them constantly. They became commonplace. It was just something you saw on your way to work and you didn't really think about it. So we've gone far, and I think people have made it out as if we haven't gone... They haven't gone as far as we really have. The revisionist history sometimes changes the facts of what really happened.
Well, I think people fall into like one of a number of different categories. One is people are just not aware. Like they're so focused on their day-to-day life that they don't pay attention to the progress or the regression of the world. Like these just aren't issues for them. So they're maybe not stagnating, but they're in a bubble, right? So that's one type of person. The other type of person, I think, they're disappointed because they see all the troubles in the world that are yet to be solved. And they get, I think maybe the people that fall in that category don't recognize the progress that has taken place. And there's not progress across the board in every area, and it's to various degrees, but there has been progress. And you can look back, and at least in my lifetime, I can see progress in some areas and regression in others. But if you're so focused on the problems, you could forget that, hey, there has been progress in some areas in the world. Then there's the people that think we've solved so many problems that they forget that there are really people who are suffering, or they've become so comfortable because their standard of living is okay. They forget that there are still homeless people and there are still wars and, you know, third world countries and people who don't have clean drinking water. And it's just, and it's, again, they're in a different kind of bubble where they think we've made more progress than we really have.
I'm a bit of an armchair historian, so I don't know how qualified I am to say this, but you know, I am an amateur historian. I do love history, and as I have studied history, I have come to realize that sometimes the periods of greatest progress come from some of the most difficult periods of human history. And it fascinates me that as I look back on some of the great societies, some of the great empires, you know, our world has seen, and to see the progress that they made in Egypt, in Rome, in Greece, to see that kind of progress and to see it lay in rubble, in ruins, quite literally, and you know that there is, for instance, in Rome, we kind of mentioned this last week, you know, Rome fell not because of outward influence, but because of inward influence. They imploded basically in on themselves. Egypt was kind of the same way, you know, Greece, so on and so forth. So these cultures, many of them stagnated, and there was a period, a lull, and then some kind of tragedy caused, you know, out of those ashes, another empire to rise. And I think America, by and large, a product of, you know, the revolution and two world wars, and and just in the last 100 years, I think about, you know, for instance, Zachary, you and I talk about our interest in our family histories, our genealogies, and I'm sure you can speak to this as can I. I think about my grandmother who would have turned 100 years old this year. And I think about the last 100 years since the time that she was born. Automobiles were really a new thing that only, you know, the wealthiest people had. And in her lifetime, you know, we saw Great Depression, we saw a world war, and those two tragedies, and then the prosperity of the 50s and so on. And, you know, we progressed technology, and there was the technology boom. And then all of a sudden, you know, here we are. When she passed away, you know, cell phones were, you know, still kind of a new thing. And, you know, here we are in these years since she's been gone, and I've gone from, you know, a candy bar cell phone to this smartphone that I've got sitting here on my desk. So I see technological progress, and I see some cultural progress, and I see some economic progress, but that progress hasn't always come easy. Sometimes it's born out of the ashes of tragedy.
I was thinking about this before the show. I was trying to think about different mechanisms for cultural change. What are the different causal factors that influence the change of culture, either in a small scale or in a grander scale, you know, world history scale, or in Star Trek, the galactic scale. And, you know, I don't want to spend too much time talking about family history, but I do have a picture that I keep handy because it's a good reminder of how I got where I am. On one side of my family, in one branch of my family tree, my grandmother's grandfather was a Civil War veteran. And he was actually for the South, and he got captured and was let go at the end of the Civil War under condition that he moved west, like, get out of Dodge, like, you know, we'll let you get out of prison, but go. And so he moved to Nebraska and built a sod house. And sod, for everyone who doesn't know what sod is dirt, right? Literally, you make bricks out of sod and build a house out of dirt. Because there were no trees on the plains, right? So if you're going to build a house, you had to build it out of like sod bricks. So I've got this photograph from the mid-1800s of this dirt sod house that my great-great-grandfather built. And so think about that. In the course of, what is that, five generations, my family on that branch went from living in a dirt house in Nebraska to, you know, a fairly urban, comfortable, middle-class lifestyle with all of the creature comforts that come along with it. And there was a progression. That wasn't like an overnight change. There was a progression from living in a dirt house to working in a nice office building in San Francisco when I was doing that, right? And that was not an overnight change. That was a smooth transition. And it occurred to me that one of the most important factor there that led to that was education. Over a period of generations, there was a progressive increase in education that led to a progressive increase in lifestyle. Now, that's not the same thing as culture per se, but it certainly is change over time. And that got me thinking about what are the different vehicles that promote cultural change. Education is one of them. We talked about wars, like in Star Trek, we see World War III and we see the eugenics wars, and that promotes cultural change. Something rises from the ashes of that. We see contact with alien civilizations. I mean, imagine if that happened here. Imagine if tomorrow we contacted an alien civilization. Our culture would change. I don't know how it would change, but it would certainly change. While all this is going on, we have biological evolution. You know, every creature on our planet is evolving, you know, whether naturally or artificially now with genetic manipulation that we can do. Certainly there's technological progress. And these are all different factors that stream together, flow together into a river of cultural change. Not the great material continuum, but a river of cultural change. And I guess my point is there are so many different threads that promote cultural change, and they feed together into whatever trajectory we end up being on. And it's not clear what's around the bend, right? All of these streams that I mentioned, we are a reality for us now. And we can't predict very well what the outcome will be. We know there's change for sure. I'd hesitate to say we know for sure whether there's going to be long-term progress. Certainly there'll be progress in some areas and maybe some regression in others. Maybe we'll have a dialectic back and forth and we'll have some long-term overall progress. We don't know, but I was thinking it would be interesting just to talk about some of the different factors that promote cultural change, either historically or sociologically or economically. And it's not really in the domain of philosophy. This is more like history and sociology, so I'm a little out of my element. And when in doubt, I'm going to do what philosophers always do. I'm just going to ask the right questions and let you guys figure it out.
So absolutely, guys, we want to talk about some of these possible vehicles for cultural change. But before we do, Zachary, you made a point in your opening statement talking about the trajectory that Star Trek seems to imply regarding the cultural and social evolution of other worlds being very similar to that of our own. And I think that's an important point before we dive in again to some of these possible vehicles for change. I'd like to kind of revisit that, because I'm thinking of a Voyager episode, Zachary, and you're the Voyager wonk between the two of us, blink of an eye. I think there's no better example in Star Trek of how Star Trek implies sometimes that there is a set trajectory for social and cultural evolution.
That's a great episode. If you're interested in this topic at all, you should watch Blink of an Eye and Voyager, because that episode is a microcosm, I think, of Star Trek's overall view about cultural progress. In that episode, we see a very linear but long-term look into a culture over millennia. We don't just get a little window into that culture in a short period of time. We get to see the long-term evolution of a culture on a particular world. The culture that we see in that episode is very linear. We see them in the Stone Age. We see them in the Bronze Age. We see them in the Industrial Age. And eventually, even further technologically beyond where Voyager's at by the end of the episode. But it's very linear. And I think that's overall Star Trek's view about cultural evolution, that if you pick any random world, and this is what happens in Star Trek, you get a random starship bebopping around the galaxy, happening upon a random world. And when you look at a random world, you can go, oh, they're basically in their equivalent of the Stone Age, or their equivalent of the Bronze Age, or their equivalent of the Industrial Age, or they're technological just like we are. They have warp drive like we do, so now we can contact them, right? But it's all very linear and very predictable, and there are these nice, easy-to-understand categories, probably a little overly simplistic. The changes between those transitions here in our own world were more nuanced than that. It's not like you snap your fingers and you go from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age, but certainly there are qualitative differences between those time periods, but we can look at that and say, well, there was progress there, and it's fairly linear and fairly cumulative, at least technologically. So, and Star Trek seems to imply this, that if you take a random world, leave it be, don't interact with it until they have warp drive, and let them evolve, they will evolve all the technology it takes to develop warp drive, and they will develop culturally to the point where they can solve their own problems, and they're quote-unquote ready to join the Federation. Mm-hmm. And it connotes a very linear, predictable, very reliable trajectory towards the Star Trek vision of the future.
Yeah, because in Blink of an Eye, again, is the best example I can think of, because, you know, it's kind of contained right there in that one episode, this entire evolution of this society, right? You know, right up to them having technology that's really in some ways more advanced than Starfleet. And so, but every time we get an episode where there is, you know, a duck blind happening or, you know, some type of observation going, I mean, for Pete's sake, we refer to cultures, other planets, other civilizations that have not yet progressed to the point that the Federation is. We call them pre-warp societies. They're always referred to as pre-warp societies. So there's this implication here that every society at some point or another is going to evolve to the point where they develop, as you said, Zachary, warp technology. And there's something about that just doesn't seem to ring true for me, because it occurs to me that social and cultural evolution is something that is driven by, and that gets us kind of back to these possible vehicles for cultural change. It's something that's driven by factors that aren't necessarily uniform or static from place to place, planet to planet, culture to culture.
Well, this is where I really want to hear from Patrick, because it's issues like this, issues surrounding the notion of progress, where philosophers really butt heads and come to blows with historians and come to blows with sociologists, because sociologists and historians tend to be a little skeptical of the notion of cultural trajectory, cultural progress. But undoubtedly, that's what we see in the Star Trek universe. There's a strong notion of progress, this linear trajectory. And I think knowledge generally works like that. I mean, I think you would be naive to say we don't know more now than we did 100 years ago. What we do with it is an open question, right? We may use it ethically, we may not use it ethically. We may use it wisely, we may not use it wisely. More people may be educated or fewer people may be educated. You can still have divisions and real problems to be solved in terms of, access to this knowledge and what we do with it, and, you know, whether wise people are making the important decisions. But knowledge itself is somewhat cumulative. I guess the interesting question for me is whether that sort of cultural progression is likewise cumulative. Do we learn the lessons culturally and historically that will lead to cultural progress like we see in technological progress?
Well, Patrick, it sounds like Zachary's expecting some fisticuffs here. He's talking about going to blows. The good news is I won't let this break out into an East Coast, West Coast, you know, throwdown. I'm here in Dallas. I'll keep things nice. And...
I was hoping for a New York street fight.
But we definitely want to hear your perspective on this, Patrick.
Here comes Fruling. Whip out a switchblade.
But so to answer that, I would think that from my point of view anyway, and I would believe that culturally, I think we always do move forward. We just might not realize it. Even if we seem to be going backwards, actually, it's a step. It may be a step forward. An example of that would be actually Star Trek Insurrection, where the Briar Patch is named from, where you got me. They actually went so far forward, they gave up their warp technology because they saw it as a means to war. They didn't see the peace and the utopian attributes that the Federation see it for. They saw it as, well, everyone that we've ever seen build up their weapons and build up their technology built weapons, and then they use those weapons to use on other people. They never really got to the point, however, where you were mutually... You had weapons that are mutually destructive that would stop you from using them in the first place, I guess. That's how I would see that. Because some people would theorize that if you both have nuclear weapons, no one's going to use them first. So maybe they never got to that point. They were still one-upping each other when they often left. But I do think that knowledge is cumulative, but misinformation is also cumulative over a society where we end up with a whole lot of people believing completely separate things, and both can't be true. You know, you take the debate between, and I don't want to pick a side, but you take the debate between vaccines or non-vaccines, or, you know, the anti-vaxxers. You can't have both of those statements be true. They can't be really, really good for you and really, really bad for you all at once. They're either good or bad. And both sides have what they believe to be science, claiming the other side has pseudoscience in their favor. Well, one of them has really bad science, and one of them doesn't. And that can be said about almost every topic we've come up with, almost every bit of information we've come up with since the beginning of man has now, and it seems more prevalent now since, say, the 1970s or so, where these anti-movements are just as big as the original movement to begin with.
This is definitely a contemporary concern where more and more there's a concern that people are living in a thought bubble, that they're only consuming the information that reinforces their already existing worldview, that they're not taking the other side's evidence or the other side's reasoning into account. And there's no sort of objective standpoint from which you can adjudicate. And it really is an attack on the whole concept of knowledge, the concept of critical thinking. And it's happening without people realizing that it's happening. So I guess one question is, you know, what is the answer to that is an interesting question here for us on Earth today. But in the Star Trek universe, why has that ceased to be a problem in the 23rd and 24th centuries? Why isn't there a 24th century thought bubble? I mean, certainly they have all the technology we do writ large, right? So you can certainly limit your access to whatever information. How does Gene Roddenberry's future get around this notion of a thought bubble that has become so problematic here in the real world?
Well, I believe in Gene Roddenberry's version, one, the issue of scarcity plays a huge role in this, because even though our middle class is much better today, people still feel like they're running paycheck to paycheck, which changes things a lot. They have to worry a lot more about that and a lot less about going and finding the real science. Secondly, as we've gotten more away from the World War, the last big catastrophe that brought everyone back together, people in general, in my opinion, want to be at odds with something. Most people want a reason to fight. Maybe not a person, but an ideal, a thing. They want a reason because that gives them a reason to keep getting up every morning to do something. It's kind of like a hobby, sadly. But I feel people feel like they need something to rally against just as much as they need something to rally for, or vice versa. So you have those two sides always at odds with each other. And as they split farther apart, it becomes harder to admit when your ideal may be wrong. Or if you take politics, for instance, you might be on the left or the right, and they might say one thing you disagree with wholeheartedly, but it's much harder to admit that because then the other side jumps all over that one weakness. So it just becomes, you become believing more and more, even the statements you don't like from those politicians. And that's, in my opinion, that's the path that a lot, it's not just here, it's not just Western Europe, a lot of the world is now following that path.
You know, I remember hearing a quote from Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, some years ago. This was a long time ago, actually. And he said that death was the best invention of life. Because eventually the people who just don't get the trajectory that things are on, of course, he was talking about technological trajectories, but cultural as well. You know, people who just don't get the way of the future, they're stuck in the past or they're stuck in their own ways, will eventually get old and die, and they'll be replaced by young people who probably think about it differently than they do. And it might be that simple. I mean, death itself, the fact that we're only here for, you know, some number of decades means that if you look at world history and by extension, future world history in the Star Trek universe in terms of centuries and millennia instead of year by year, decade by decade, if you look at it in that grand scale, culture changes pretty quickly given the relatively short human lifespan compared to, say, Vulcans in the Star Trek universe. This, presumably, Vulcan culture wouldn't change nearly as rapidly because of the long lifespan that Vulcans have.
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the Vulcans, because as we're sitting here kind of talking back and forth, the Vulcan culture, it piqued my curiosity because we don't really know a great deal about their social and cultural evolution. I mean, we know that at one point in time in their history, they were just as emotional, if not more so, than humans. And they were very warlike and very violent. And in fact, they irradiated Vulcan with nuclear weapons. And, you know, so we see a shadow, if you will, of the same mistakes that we've made here on Earth. And the question that I have is, well, how did they get from there to here? And we started to see a little bit of this, little glimpses of it in Enterprise. We never really got to see it really fleshed out, you know? So the question is, how did they get from there to where they are? Because it seems to me that they've been able to trade their debate for something that's more like a dialectic, and they're able to solve problems and come to conclusions and solutions without, you know, these emotionally laden arguments. They're able to see things from more than one point of view. And really, in many ways, that's what makes someone like Spock or Tuvok or, you know, insert any Vulcan character you want to. That's what, to some degree, I think, makes them superior to humans when it comes to finding solutions to problems.
Yeah, and the Vulcans are interesting because I really get the sense that the Vulcans kind of pulled that trick off out of sheer willpower, collectively or as individuals, they were able to use their reason to subsume that emotional impulse that they have, which is still there and it's latent. We know that about Vulcans. But I think reasoning is like this. I mean, critical thinking and good reasoning skills is like this. It's hard. It takes discipline. It really is kind of mind over matter in a way to develop good reasoning skills, to put the effort in it takes to weigh all sides and think about different arguments, pro and con things. That is much harder than relying on your biases and your impulses and your gut reactions. And there is an element of mastering all of those other factors when you're learning critical thinking skills. And that just takes work. And honestly, we're all a little lazy, especially when we live in this age when we have so many creature comforts. So in my mind, it makes total sense that people are not as willing to challenge themselves to put in the effort to master, you know, those other impulses they have. I'm not just talking like biological impulses, but I'm talking about, you know, the things that come to you kind of from the gut, sentimentalism and biases, you know, your gut reactions to things versus actually thinking things through logically and rationally and based on facts. But that takes more work. And the Vulcans seem to have put in the work it takes to master, you know, their emotional component that was, you know, holding them back culturally. And I don't think we should progress like Vulcans. In fact, this is what's interesting about the Star Trek universe. In Star Trek, the original series, we don't see humans turning into Vulcans, right? We see that humans have maintained all of the things that make them human. All of the internal conflicts and struggles are there on the bridge of the original Enterprise, right? We have the the trinity of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, mm-hmm. right? We've got, you know, McCoy's passionate, passionate and compassionate side. We've got Spock bringing his reasoning and his logical abstract component, and Kirk as reason to kind of adjudicate between these two opposing forces. But the important thing is those are all still present for humans. They haven't been weeded out by the 23rd century or by the 24th century, although Star Trek The Next Generation gets a little closer to more idealized humans who have weeded out some of those passions that define the original series so well. So I guess my fundamental question is, given all of that, which parts of human nature are likely to remain the same as we evolve culturally, and which parts of our human natures actually will evolve over time? I think Star Trek makes an interesting claim that even in the 23rd century, all of those impulses that define the internal struggle that we're kind of making the case that it's held us back culturally, that those have actually persisted into the future in the Star Trek universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ongoing struggle. I guess, you know, we'll never become the idealized humans who don't have that internal struggle.
No, but it's interesting you guys brought up Enterprise, because I find that that's like the first and really only place you see subcultures within a culture. I mean, you get the Maquis, who I guess would be considered a subculture, or in DS9, I guess they delve into it a little bit. But really the first time you see a group that's not... really, like, not a terrorist group, but like a subculture. So you had the one set of Vulcans who were ruling Vulcan, and then you had the others who were trying to teach everyone. But so you had the two versions of this going on at one time, and you actually, I've talked about this before, where the change was too quick. In the beginning of Enterprise, you know, you see the Vulcans, you're like, oh, it's Vulcans. And then, like, halfway through, you're like, oh, man, they're like more like Romulans. They're lying to people. They're
jerks.
Like, this doesn't make it, which turned out great. I loved that fact. And even towards the end of it, like, Archer comes back and he ended up finding a ship out there with a whole bunch of Vulcans that were dying or dead. And they wanted to, like, pin it on him, like, put him in prison. It's not a very Vulcan thing to do. But you find out through all of this that they're going through a cultural change right then. That's happening now. But there was already a culture that had changed. And maybe it was just the people on top that were defining the culture that hadn't yet. And I think you might see that happen a lot in cultures too, where the culture itself has already changed. It's different. It's just the people on top look a certain way. And that's how outwardly it looks to the rest of the world or universe or whatever. Because they never really delve into that in any other part of Star Trek, really, is the subcultures.
This is one of the things that fascinates me and infuriates me at the same time about Star Trek, because it's laden with these contradictions. And you make a great point about, you know, Vulcan civilization is on the precipice of this cultural change, and, you know, we see that. But then we also, again, going back to the pre-warp, and you made a great point about the Baku being kind of this post-warp society. There's this suggestion within the Star Trek universe that every society, every culture, every alien planet, every species is on this same trajectory. And you know, I don't know what's after the Baku. Do they evolve into, say, the Organians?
Well, the Baku were great because that's a great example of Star Trek breaking its own rules, which is always fun. And generally, the rule in Star Trek is nice, predictable cultural evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But here we get a society that this is what happens.
It's
inside
a post-warp
Star Trek and,
society.
Right. That's my point exactly. You know, when we first see the Baku in Insurrection, you could very naturally assume that they're a pre-warp society, right? They have no technology and they live a fairly agrarian kind of simplistic, you know, mm-hmm. non-technological society. And then only later in the movie do we realize, oh, they've just turned their backs on technology and they're more advanced than we are. And that kind of breaks the trope of stumbling upon a planet, you know, at a certain fixed stage of cultural evolution. But let me try to ask the question a slightly different way, because I think this is kind of the crux of the issue. If we maintain, as I think we see in the Star Trek universe, that humans will continue to have the passions that define human nature, we're not going to resolve these conflicts away like the Vulcans have largely succeeded in doing, even though they have this lurking inner tension. But assuming that humans don't go that direction, that we basically continue to be the kind of being we are now that has these struggles are more of a problem for us than they are for Vulcans. What allows humans to deal with those struggles more effectively inside the Star Trek universe? It can't just be as simple as, well, in the 24th century, they put counselors on the bridge of the Enterprise, and so everyone works out their feelings, you know? Like, what what allows humans to deal with their issues more constructively than that in the future, given that we're basically the same kind of being now that we see in the Star Trek universe in the future in a couple hundred years?
Well, I don't think we necessarily have to change our emotions or our passions. We just need to learn how to focus them better. You know, one of the things about a post-scarcity society is you need to find an excuse to work at that point. Otherwise, if you know you're going to be fed and you have a roof, well, why get up in the morning? Just turn television on. There'll be nothing on TV because nobody will be an actor.
Oh, I'll just play Star Trek Online all day.
Right, but that's only if a developer develops the rest of Star Trek Online patch 2024. You know, I mean, these people have to want to do these things. You have to want to be a captain of a starship or an ensign of a starship, or you a farmer, and then farming wouldn't be for money anymore, so it wouldn't be mass produced farmlands. It would be people who actually love to farm. These are their passions, and this is what they want to do. Sisko's in love with baseball, so he sets up holodeck programs for baseball. You have other people who Chakotay whittles, as you know from the journey to the journey. So, I mean, those are passions.
Inside joke.
And they have to be cultivated so that we have to be at a point where we can worry more about what we love to do with our passions than arguing what person or political party or, you know, I'm a Yankee fan and you're not, you know.
Well, I think what you're describing, Patrick, I think you're describing a shift away from pure consumer culture to something like more like towards something like what we see in, say, the maker movement, where people are taking their passions and their talents and their skills and putting those together constructively to create something new, to be more authentic, than purely sitting back and consuming whatever, you know, the media or whatever technology presents at them passively. So some sort of active involvement in you know, creating something of your own vision or creating something in the world to make the world a better place, but that kind of active participation versus pure consumerism.
Right, but I it's funny because I just said that, and now I'm going to contradict myself slightly for a second before fixing it. There's a theory called conspicuous consumerism, where you really only buy things because you want people to see it. If I just needed a car, I'd buy the cheapest car that got me to work, but if I bought a BMW, I want people to notice I own a BMW or a Mercedes-Benz.
Out here in California, it's a Prius, by the way, I'm just saying.
Yeah, right. So, but yeah, but that's my point. Like, that's how this works. People buy bigger and better things that they don't necessarily need, spend more money for, so they get noticed. However, in the Federation, the Utopian Federation that we see, the conspicuous consumerism is the knowledge. It's I created the hologram doctor, the hollow doctor, because I want people to know me as the guy who created the hollow doctor. I didn't do it.
Well, that sounds like it's channeling our baser instincts, the need for recognition and acceptance and fame even, but using that in a more constructive way. Like, it's okay to write a new novel for the sake of, you know, becoming famous, a new holo novel in Star Trek, right? But hey, you still write a great holo novel, and it does actually change the world culturally, even though it was done from a selfish motivation.
Right, and I think we see that in Star Trek, because I think we see a lot of people who are very arrogant. Noonien Sun, he did it to create androids. He didn't do it to better the universe necessarily. He's arrogant. He wanted to create something that no one's ever created and be known for it. It's not a bad thing. Gordon Gekko says greed is good. That's true, and even
so
more
did Quark.
True.
Yeah.
What?
So did Quark, I think.
Yeah, he did a few times. but this is even more true of the Federation. But the greed that you're going for, the currency isn't money anymore. It's something else, and what allows for even more competition among people, although it's cordial competition. But what creates that is the ability to not worry about doing menial jobs. You can create robots or holograms or replicators to do all the dirty jobs nobody wants to do. So, okay, there's not.
Yeah, but eventually, Patrick, those holograms go crazy and they end up killing all of the biological life forms on the ship.
That's terrible. That's just, and then those, utopian
those
society is
biological
over.
Biological things.
There's sweat and those grime sweat. All over the place.
Guys, it occurs to me that there's another position, and kind of back to the Baku thing, because I'm completely stuck on this. Yeah, Patrick, I'll give you props for kind of blowing my mind with your Baku example, because it raises all kinds of interesting questions. So could it be said that Star Trek's position in terms of the way forward could possibly be backward? Because if that's the case, then I'm just mind blown, because if that's the case, then the episode Paradise from DS9 takes a completely different connotation
with
me.
Okay, here's my two cents on this, because the general Star Trek chain of reasoning is this. We solve all the problems of scarcity by the use of technology. So technology is what allows us to invent replicators and move from point A to point B with transporters and great medical advances, and it just solves all those problems. So technology is what creates the utopian place where people have the liberty to be the more authentic versions of themselves. And what we're seeing in the Baku is that they have they've reached that point, and they've kind of abandoned the technology part. But what happens with the Baku is that we get some fantasy elements thrown in, right? It's not just technology that keeps them healthy. We have this metaphysic stuff with the rings that keeps them healthy all the time, right? So they can abandon the technology because they don't need to stay healthy anymore, right? I think if you abandon the kind of the fantasy elements of what we see in Star Trek Insurrection, you get a little closer to the Star Trek vision, which is that in order to create that space for people to be authentic, we really do need to have technological progress to solve the actual problems that constrain people.
Because it seems to me, and again, I'm completely thinking about this in a new way right here, right now. I mean, I'm completely thinking about this in a new way as we're speaking. It seems to me that Star Trek does raise the question from time to time. I'm thinking about Paradise. I mean, could Alexis have been right? I'm thinking about episodes like Let He Who's Without Sin. I'm thinking about those kinds of episodes where the sort of fat and sassy culture of the Federation is called to question. You know, is technology making us lazy? Have we lost touch with? And we could be asking those kinds of questions now. For instance, you know, it amazes me that as I walk down a city street here in the Dallas area, and I know this is true not just in this country, but it's true around the world. I walk around and I see these people with their faces down in their smartphones, and they're just... We have become socially backwards to some degree as a result of these crazy little things that we all carry around. So, you know, it causes me to question: Are we moving in the right direction? And now, all of a sudden, as I think about the Baku, and as I'm making these distinctions, and as I'm drawing these little lines here, I'm thinking about these episodes like Paradise and like Let He Is Without Sin. It seems to me that Star Trek raises that question from time to time: Is progress always moving forward, or is it sometimes looking backward?
It sounds like what you're asking, to reframe the question a little bit, it sounds like you're asking whether technology is the final solution or an intermediate step towards a post-technological era that's more, even more utopian than the technological society we see in Star Trek. I don't have an answer to that, but I bet Patrick does.
Well, no pressure. I think in Star Trek, the answer is actually no, it's not. I think people get tired of technology, and that technology is not always used correctly, but they always find a quirky way to allow people to live. Like with the Baku, they have the rings that keep them alive forever, so they don't need to worry about technology. With Paradise, you find that they're willing to let a person die rather than get medicine from a ship. And they were all tricked into being there. At the end of the episode, they end up wanting to stay because that's their new life. But they didn't know they were going there until until they were there. And then once they were there, they didn't realize they were not going to get off. And she keeps trying to convince Sisko and Miles, you have to stop this idea of getting out of here. Just give up the idea because you're not helping anyone. But they were trying to help themselves, and they ended up helping everyone. And they gave the people the ability to decide whether they want to stay or not, and they ended up deciding to stay, which is fine. It's just, but now they do, now they, you assume they would have access to some of these medicines and other things, which change things a lot. So there's a certain amount of technology we need to get to. But on your point of the cell phones and the smartphones and laptop computers, there, I feel, this is way over dramatic, that they're destroying society is not the case. But they're making it so people can't even speak to each other anymore. You used to, you go to a party now, and most people are on their phones half of it. If someone has to give an announcement, they're trying to find someone to do it for them. My wife was just at a baby shower.
In all fairness, Patrick, people gave the same arguments about telephones 100 years ago and the telegraph before that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think as things become more routine in a society, we actually drop off using them as much or to the degree that we use them. You know, you wouldn't go home to call somebody on your phone anymore. But before, that was kind of a cool thing to do, so it became a trend to use the phone more and knock on the neighbor's door less. I think people now would knock on
the
door.
The death of civilization. No more knocking. No more front porches in the neighborhood.
No, but it's true, though.
But that's true, though, because we don't actually build houses with front porches because we don't need them anymore.
No,
like,
we don't.
Like we used to.
There's no need for them. And now, it used to be when I was a child in the early 80s, if someone knocked on the door, everyone ran to the door to find out who was getting a visitor. Now if someone knocks on your door, everyone runs to the door to see, why is someone at my door?
That's true. I catch myself doing that all the time.
I didn't get a text. No one's on their way. Why is someone here? I don't expect a package, you know? So things have changed. But I get that they made the argument for the telegraph and the telephone. But I think as we get farther away from that, we actually start heading backwards, back into a more comfortable zone of human interaction that we just right now, we're just so obsessed with the technology. We use it more or we rely on it more than we probably should. It's not that we can't. It works. It's reliable. I can get online from subways now, underground.
Well, I think undeniably, though, there's two facets to this, right? There's the facet of what is the Star Trek vision of the role of technology and how that leads to a better society. And that's, even in the Star Trek universe, that's open for debate, like we've pointed out. And then there's, what does that mean for us here in the real world? I think it's undeniable, at least, that here in the real world, technology, for better or worse, regardless of what effect it actually has, will be one of the driving factors that leads to cultural change, as I see it. Now, you can interpret that two ways. There's the Star Trek way of interpreting that in terms of progress. Then there's the dystopian way of interpreting that, like the Terminator, right? Yeah. So it's an open question whether it's certainly technology will lead to change, cultural change or otherwise. We can talk about the pros and cons, what it's doing for our human relationships here in the real world. But I think if we're going looking for causal factors, I keep zeroing in on technology as one of the driving factors of change for better or worse.
And I'm not trying to draw any conclusions here, but you know, it's frightening to think as I consider Paradise, and I've always thought that Alexis was a couple stem bolts shy of being self-sealing, but as we sit here and talk,
sorry, your stem bolt is leaking.
As we sit here and talk about this, though, I mean, it raises some interesting questions about whether or not she was onto something. Because, again, if Star Trek is implying that there could be this post-warp society that leads to something like the Baku, that leads to something like the Organians, you know, at some point in time, if that's, you know, if that's the roadmap, so to speak, that Star Trek is either in one degree or another kind of paving for us, then I think it raises, again, some interesting questions.
I think we're missing an important piece of the Star Trek puzzle. We've spent a lot of time today talking about the external factors that lead to cultural change, the various constraints and technological or political factors that lead to change. But we're forgetting that Star Trek really does have an internal driving force for change. Star Trek has a lot of faith in human beings' ability to recognize a problem, get a few people together, think through it together rationally, and solve a problem together as people, coming from the inside, regardless of whatever external constraints there are. And what I see around me in a great many people, even people that should know better, they're well-educated, they know what's possible and what's not possible, people have become defeatists. They see a lot of external constraints that really are open to change. And I know I keep going back to this because it's on my mind right now, and I think it's really relevant. I was thinking of another quote from Steve Jobs, and he said, the most important thing, if you want to kind of be successful or change the world, is to realize that the world you see around you, everything you know of as life as you know it, all of the stuff from your house to your technology to your car, everything that makes up your day-to-day life was basically invented by people who are no smarter than you are. And when you realize that, you realize that you can poke it, you can prod it, you can change the world, you can come up with an idea and you can make it, you can make the world different than it is. It's malleable, it's not fixed, there are no constraints. Mm-hmm. And most people approach life from a defeatist standpoint. And in Star Trek, we don't see that. We don't see people being defeatist. They say, here's the world we want to create, here's the problem to be solved, let's get a few people together and work at the problem and make it better. And it almost ignores all of these external constraints we've been talking about, and places a much greater degree of faith in human beings' ability to change the world from within.
Well, I think for the most part, the average person wouldn't consider themselves a defeatist.
No, they wouldn't. They think they don't think of themselves right, as defeatists. That's what's interesting about
it. So while you have that, I think also once you get to the post-scarcity part, then you would lose a lot of defeatists because they have no more excuses. They just have to kind of admit that they're defeatist, and we wouldn't see them on Star Trek. You know,
They'd hang out in the dark, wearing black, reading, you know, bad poetry on their space
iPads. Right, and that would be it, and they'd be vaping and stuff like that, but that's kind of where it would go. So,
space vaping.
But that's it. I mean, we wouldn't see them because they would be the guys who a lot of economists worry about would be the ones that if you give out things for free, they're just going to be lazy, right? So this the defeatist, the best of the defeatist, I guess, would be the way you'd put it. But the ones who are the worst and just could not survive, they would just kind of be. They would just exist. The rest of society would have to pull together to do all the other things, but really they'd be the ones benefiting from it anyway. The defeatists would still just kind of be existing and not benefiting from the new form of society. And like you said, the defeatists today don't know they're defeatists. They think they're great, and some of the worst defeatists are the ones who brag the most about how awesome they are.
Until Captain Janeway comes and springs him out of that penal colony and then strands him in the Delta Quadrant.
Right, way better turnout. I was fine. It was nice. It was sunny. Now I'm here.
And let's face it, that's kind of Tom Paris at the beginning of Voyager. He's kind of that guy. He's sort of a defeatist. He's certainly not bought into this utopian future. He's gotten himself into trouble. You know, he's just kind of meandering along in life, and he winds up in a penal colony until Catherine Janeway shows up one day with a mission.
Absolutely. And it's also, and I know people are going to kill me on Babel Conference for this, it's also Kirk from the JJ verse. He's just kind of picking fights and doing, and it's not till someone challenges him to be a good captain that he finds a reason to not just kind of mull through life.
And you can connect with Patrick Devlin on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5.
Awesome.
That's awesome. I'm just getting that out there so people can love on you in the Twitterverse too.
Yes, yes, they will.
I know that reality is probably somewhere in the middle, but I feel like we're too far towards one extreme. Like in the Star Trek universe, I get the sense that the vast majority of people, the Tom Paris's aside, really wake up every day and go, "What problem can I solve? What can I do to make the universe a better place? What can I learn today?" And that's their driving force. And that's with them from the moment they, you know, step out of the sonic shower to the moment they go to bed at night in their quarters. But here on Earth, there are people who do that, but not as many, I think, right? There's a lot of people that just get up, they have their coffee, they go to work, you know, and then they take whatever life throws at them. But, you know, all of us, I think, could do just a little bit better job of waking up every day going, what problem can I solve today? You know, and if everyone did that, we would, I think, develop that internal impulse that is a little closer to what we see in Star Trek.
Right, but Star Trek uses World War III to get people to do that initially.
Like, and Geordi PowerPoints.
Geordi PowerPoints are great.
But can't we skip that part and just go, can't we do that now? Why do we need World War III to do that? And certainly if we had a World War III, that would lead to change, and it might even lead to, you know, I mean, I'm a little more skeptical. I think, you know, Star Trek is a little overly utopian, and realistically a World War III wouldn't quite get us there even if we had a World War III. That's my take on that. But why can't we skip the World War III part and just go, hey, wait a minute, we're smart people. What can we do to make the world a better place today, right here, right now? Let's not wait for World War III to roll around.
Well, do we know that in theory we're not doing that? We just have completely different views on what that is. I mean, part of the problem is I think we have growing pains. That, again, we're back to the right and the left side cannot come together. And after a war, they come together. But the problem is they can't hold there. They never hold there. They end up back in the same extreme problems later on. And the first time we avoid that breakage, that at least that extreme breakage, then we can possibly move towards a Federation utopia. But you're never going to get there in the waves we've gone through over the last 1,000 years.
And I love some of the jabs that Star Trek takes at this kind of thing. Like, you know, fundamentally, I think we're still kind of selfish people, that even if we had everything we wanted, we would still be selfish and we would still hoard stuff, and our human nature wouldn't change very much. But in Star Trek, we see, like, I think we see Quark making fun of gold, like, oh, it's just gold. It's not worth anything. And to me, that's just a jab at human selfishness, right? We're still going to care about hoarding, you know, precious metals in 200 years. And it's cute in my mind that in Star Trek, they kind of laugh at that. Guys, we've kind of come at this topic from every possible angle. Patrick, would you like to wrap us up with any final thoughts on the topic before we send you back to your metaphasic radiation?
Yeah, I'd like to say, I think we hit this from a lot of different point of views and different ways that they can go from here to there. And if it does happen, it probably wouldn't even be in the time frame Star Trek supposes it would be. But I do think Star Trek does give that linear timeline, and I don't think we'll ever see something that cut and dry in our society or cultures or historical evolutions. It's just, there's too much back and forth play to get there in the first place, that if it was so linear, I don't think it would be a great place to be in the first place, because everyone would just kind of be marching to the same drum all the way up to it, and there really wouldn't be much difference. So, I mean, I hope we end up there one day. I hope it doesn't take World War III, IV, or V to get there. I just don't know if we'll ever get to a place where you don't need money because there's no scarcity. Even if we can transverse the galaxy, there'll still be people mining planets.
Well, Patrick, first of all, I want to say it's been a real pleasure to have you on the podcast, and I'm glad we were finally able to make this happen, and thank you for suggesting this topic. It's been a lot of fun talking about this. You know, if nothing else, for my final thoughts, I still say that Alexis from Paradise is a couple of nacelles short of a Constitution class ship, but I definitely look at her, and I definitely look at Paradise a little differently now than I did when we started this conversation. I'm not ready to jump and say the way forward is back. I'm not anywhere near there, but you know, looking at the Baku and kind of making these connections and thinking about, you know, this trajectory that I think that we're on and, you know, possibly headed, I think that there's something there within the Baku culture, within that episode of Paradise, that I think is relevant. And I'm not so quick to dismiss those ideas now after this conversation. As far as, you know, our trajectory, I just want to say that again, I think that Star Trek is laden with these contradictions. In some episodes, it seems that they are consistent in this idea that every species is headed in the same trajectory, and suggesting that we're all headed in this trajectory of cultural evolution, social evolution. And I tend to reject that idea outright, because there are just too many vehicles, I think, that influence cultural change. And I think that the way in our universe, I think the way that we react to those vehicles, the way we react to something like a war or a particular progression in technology, or you know, the relationships that we have, you know, with other societies here on planet Earth. I think there's too many variables to project, you know, any given destination. But I think it is important to, as Zachary mentioned, to wake up every day and begin to look at the problems at hand. And you don't have to look at the big picture problems. I think it's important to, you know, to look at the immediate problems that you have. Maybe they're just problems that you're facing, you know, in your own life, not necessarily trying to solve the world's problems, but, you know, wake up tomorrow and try to solve your own. And then maybe the next day, you know, try to find a way to be that vehicle of change for somebody else, and just do that. And, you know, who knows, maybe out there in the world, you know, someone comes up with a small idea that becomes something really huge, that just as Apple has just completely changed the way we live our lives. And I think that's a very Star Trek idea.
Well, I think in terms of my final thoughts, I don't feel like Star Trek should in general get high marks from historians or sociologists for its overly simplistic linear view of cultural and technological evolution. You know, we really see a very sort of choppy, linear, progressive, simplistic account of cultural evolution like we see in Blink of an Eye and Voyager, and that Star Trek's view in general, with some notable exceptions that we've talked about today. On the other hand, I think it's really dangerous for a society to lose the notion of progress, because if you lose that notion of progress, you stagnate. And we need to make sure that we as a society are not stagnating. I mean, we're hearing even from our current president that, oh, you know, we look out, we see a wasteland of stagnation across the country. Like, that's a dangerous concept, because people do need this motivation to get up and make the world a better place every day. So I think it's important to maintain some notion of progress. And from a philosophical standpoint, I do think that knowledge is largely progressive. We know more than we did 50 years ago and 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. We know some different things too. So it's not that knowledge is totally linear and progressive, but there is a degree of cumulativeness to our notion of knowledge, specifically technological knowledge, that I think is important to hold on to. Now, the challenge in my mind is how to take that progressiveness, this notion of progress towards a better vision of the future, and make it less simplistic and maybe a bit more inclusive than we see in the Star Trek universe. You know, Patrick, earlier in the discussion, you mentioned that we don't see a lot of subcultures in Star Trek, although we do see some. Like in Voyager, we see that Native American culture has thrived into the 24th century. And we can find several examples like this as well, but we don't dwell on them very much in the Star Trek universe. So I think the challenge for us in the future is to maintain some notion of progress, recognize the true complexity of cultural and political progression over time, change over time, while maintaining some degree of inclusiveness, right? We don't want a homogenous society. We want an inclusive society that still has progress to it. Now, what that'll look like in 100 years or 1,000 years, I have no idea, but I think that's the challenge. The endpoints to avoid would be abandoning the notion of progress, or being so progressive that we're not inclusive anymore. And also just being overly simplistic. You know, there's a simplistic notion of progress, and I think that's where Star Trek really deserves some criticism. But if you recognize that cultural change and progress is more nuanced and more complex and harder earned, I think in Star Trek we sort of see, even though we know that it took World War III to get the Star Trek feature, we kind of hand wave it. We go, oh, World War III, no problem. Right? We don't talk about that very much in Star Trek. No big deal, right? I think if there's a utopian society, if there's genuine progress beyond the state of the world today, it will be hard fought and hard earned. And we get to see a little bit of that in Enterprise, but you know, the Star Trek future comes a little bit too easily. And I'm a bit more of a, for all my optimism for the power of individual humans to solve problems and make the world a better place, I'm sort of a cultural pessimist. I see a lot of stagnation and a lot of regression around me, and that makes me a bit more of a pessimist. So I hope we can find ways to overcome that in the future.
Yeah, that's my only criticism of First Contact, is that we kind of drop in at a point to where... you know, the flowers are starting to poke themselves up and, you know, the future's bright. But we know that we know the days leading up to that were horrendous. And we know that there were still struggles yet to come.
Do you think that in First Contact, in that alternate future where the Borg assimilated Earth, did they also assimilate the flowers? Are there little Borgified flowers poking out of the ground?
Borg butterflies.
Yes.
Borg butterflies.
You know, I do sort of think that, again, maybe this is final thoughts. You know, all of this matters more than most, you know, abstract issues in philosophy. This is real life. You know, if we want to build a better world, someone's got to do it, right? So hope someone just, all I hope is that someone hears this and goes, yeah, I can make the world a better place. And then Lord knows what they'll do. It has kind of a butterfly effect. You make one little thing better, and that can lead to something even better. So,
yeah, I mean,
as long as it's not a Borg butterfly,
correct? Yes. As long as they're not little nanobots, and
the Borg butterfly effect—that's hilarious.
It would literally—it could literally change an entire planet in minutes.
Well, Patrick, I promised to get you back before your skin started to sag, so we will go ahead and transport you back to the planet's surface. Enjoy the rest of your stay here in the Briar Patch. Before you go, would you like to share with our listeners how they can connect with you out there on the interwebs and around the network?
Yes, I can be found on the Babel conference. I'm always looking in on there. I might not always comment, but I'm always looking in. So if someone has something to say to me, I'll definitely catch it. They can get me on Twitter at MagicDrop5. And they can catch me around the network guesting on a few other podcasts from time to time.
Yeah, you've been a frequent visitor to Warp 5.
Yes, and Earl Grey.
Earl Grey.
Yeah, I think I heard you on Earl Grey recently.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, it's been great having you here aboard the Starship Theseus. We'll get you back so you can enjoy the sights and sounds and firmer skin of your little vacation place here in the Briar Patch. Transporter Chief, energize. Well, Zachary, again, it was a lot of fun having our associate producer, Patrick Devlin, join us for today's podcast.
That was so much fun. Patrick and I have been talking about having him on Metatracks for quite a long time. We've been talking about topics back and forth. And I know, given Patrick's background in sociology and our background in philosophy, that we'd have a fascinating discussion. And even though I sort of feel like with this discussion, it was hard for me because I'm not a sociologist and I'm not a historian. I come at things from a philosophical standpoint. I do feel like this is where the rubber meets the road, right? As much as I love all the abstract topics we talk about in philosophy and metrics, and, you know, we talk about personal identity and transporters, and I love all that stuff. I really do. On the other hand, we live in a real world that has real problems, and it is really will head into the future in one direction or another, and it is up to all of us to decide what direction it goes in. And at the same time, I'm frankly just not much of a data-driven individual. I almost don't care what the sociologists tell me about the future. And I don't care what historians tell me about what direction the future is heading in. I trust our own ability to put our heads together and solve real problems and build the world that we want to build. And I care more about that than I do about abstract philosophical issues.
Absolutely. And I have to say that, you know, once again, I've made some connections on this podcast that I had never made before. And it's caused me to think about some things both in our universe and the Star Trek universe in ways that I'm not necessarily used to. So it was really fascinating having him join us. And who knows, maybe we can do this again.
Are you saying we'll have to do this again in the future?
We can do this again in the future.
I think it depends on the future cultural evolution of our podcast.
Indeed, it may. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about cultural and social evolution today, but this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room. I bet the transporters were invented by Amazon as a way of delivering products to people.
I was totally going to say, it's like Amazon groceries would be like, yeah, I don't have to be there, but it can come like beam to my port. It's like, order, there it arrived, right there.
You know, that's like, right. Like, you've got a little Amazon dot next to the toilet, and you just tap it, and then toilet paper materializes right there.
Standard orbit.
Every fan takes what they want, what works for them, what complements a story, a series, a show, a movie, and that can be in their heart, in their mind, canon, as in like, well, you know, I love it, it makes me feel good about those characters, the story, so I believe it. Or if you don't, for one reason or another, do you say, well, for me, I'm just going to pretend that didn't happen, or it doesn't connect to the part of the universe that I like.
To the journey!
Wait, you're saying it's like matter and antimatter when they interact? They
it's like costume and non-costume.
So costumes and non-costumes annihilate each other.
Yes.
In Voyager.
That is how the universe is going to ultimately be destroyed, due to the interaction of naked people and people wearing clothes.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You can always find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. We'd love to hear your feedback. If you're not an Apple user, no worries. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps. And you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are a lot of ways that you can do that. The best place to join the larger conversation is always the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel. That's B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. It's a closed group, but if you click join, one of our admins will let you right on in. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose message to a Trek FM show and select Metatrex. That'll come right to us. You can always find the network on Twitter at Trek FM is our Twitter handle, and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And Zachary, when you're not shopping for space vaping supplies, where can our listeners find you around Trek FM and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts there, Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Frueling. And Mike, when you're not shutting down your podcast app to live a more agrarian lifestyle, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, I am most active on Facebook. You can catch me there. Certainly around the Babel Conference, I'd love to talk Star Trek and philosophy with you there. I'm on Twitter quite frequently. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701, occasionally on Instagram, and that's cmichael1701. And you can always catch my blog about my journey to publish my novel and a little bit about life. That is cmichael1701.wordpress.com. If you'd like to join Patrick and many, many others helping us keep our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include things like early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many, many more. They're all available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows every month. So we really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team here from the network specifically. We'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, our art director, Aaron Harvey, production manager, Richard Marquez, and our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. And as always, we'd like to give a huge thank you and a shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin, who joined us on today's podcast. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. And Kay Shaw, your co-host over on To the Journey, Zachary. Her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, this Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
No pressure.
I totally thought your story about your ancestor was going to go a little different. You know, you're talking about how they held him during the Civil War and then let him go under the condition. And I just was certain that you were going to break into the ballad of Jed Clampett. You know, they said they said California is the place you ought to be. So he loaded up the truck and he went to Vacaville.
No, it was actually, well,
San Francisco suburbs, you say.
Wasn't quite that simple, but.